I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/spoken today.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
This is a paid advertisement from BetterHelp. As a podcast listener, you've heard from us before. Today, let's hear from our members about what online therapy has done for them.
I would recommend my therapist 1,000 times over. She has truly changed my life.
The day after my first session, my friends and family said I sounded like myself again for the first time in weeks.
You deserve to invest in your well-being. Visit BetterHelp.com to see what it can do for you. That's better, H-E-L-P.com.
Hello and welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999, the podcast where we talk about the TV shows of 1999 from the bada bing here in 2022. I'm one of your hosts, Kenny Nybart.
And I'm Phyllis Cove.
And with us today is the man who actually popularized The Sopranos, Alan Sepinwall, late of the Star Ledger, currently of Rolling Stone, if I'm correct, right, Alan?
Yes.
but let's talk about your days at the Star Ledger, where you were the
preeminent Sopranos person, right? Like, was this the first show that you did episodic for? Or
no, I did episodic in college for NYPD Blue. That's sort of how I broke into this.
Wow.
Alan, for those of you who don't know, Alan Sepinwall invented episodic recaps for NYPD Blue in college.
No, a guy named Tim. I would love to take credit for everything you guys are giving me credit for. A math professor named Tim Lynch invented recaps for Star Trek. I read those. I'm like, oh, that's a thing you could do. And then I did it for NYPD Blue and eventually Sopranos, etc.
Right. Tim Lynch. It was Alan.
I do have a question for you, Alan.
Yes.
In terms of the Sopranos and in terms of your coverage of the Sopranos, I was not privy to this. I lived in Canada, as our listeners know. So I was not privy to sort of the Sopranos in the same way that you guys were, which is why I'm very curious to hear what you guys. So this show premieres January 10th, 1999. Did you see it previous to the premiere, or how did that
work? I did. Because, okay. I was writing TV criticism for the Star Ledger with Matt Zoller Seitz. He actually did the more intense coverage of the first three seasons, and then I took over after that because he watched it a little before me and called dibs, and and I resented the hell out of him for 3 years, and then he got burnt out and gave it to me. I'm like, really? You're going to give up on, being the rock critic in Liverpool when the Beatles are playing the Cavern or whatever.
Sure.
But I saw it and clearly this was going to be a big deal, and it was a huge deal, especially if you were writing for suburban New Jersey newspaper. I'd grown up the town next door to the town where Tony lived, the town where David Chase grew up. So I knew all of the landmarks, all the places they were going, and people went crazy for it.
What is the town? I mean, I'm so embarrassed. I don't know the answer to this. What is
Tony lives in North Caldwell, New Jersey.
All right. So I always thought, and I knew it wasn't, but I always thought it was West Caldwell, where my cousin currently lives. He's a cop there.
Yeah.
So he's a real New Jersey guy. But so it's North Caldwell. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Pinebrook, which is technically adjacent to West Caldwell. But like I kind of think of the all of the Caldwells as the Caldwell's same thing. Right. Yeah. West Caldwell is when Tony B starts setting up the massage parlor.
It's exactly. Because I remember the guy. I remember the Asian guy was like, West Caldwell, West Caldwell.
Yes. And that's in the exact spot of Book World, which was my favorite independent bookstore growing up. By that point, it had gone out of business. And so they were able to use it as the set for the massage parlor.
So interesting. So my parents are South Orange and Springfield.
Yeah.
So my cousins are Tenafly and now they're West Caldwell. And so this is Westchester.
Yeah.
We had different mobsters in Westchester. But they live next door to me. But this is all right. So Alan, let's talk a little bit about you grew up as you said,
Pinebrook.
Pinebrook. Were you aware of any actual mob influence in your town or your neighborhood?
No. Pete Yorn, the musician who also grew up in my town, years later, he told me about some like shady stuff in the music scene at the time, but I was not aware of anything. I was an oblivious kid, like reading my comic books and watching my shows.
Didn't get a sense that there were some kids who had some nicer vehicles or some a ton of people who are related in your high school, but all right,
the one
related.
Thing I will say is there was a development that went up in our neighborhood when I was like 13-14, and all those houses were vastly nicer than the ones we lived in. They were two blocks away, and one of them allegedly belonged to the guy who like had built his fortune on the pizza boxes with the cartoon of the pizza chef tossing the dough in the air. Sure. And people are like, well, he only did that because he was connected. So maybe there was that one guy.
Can I ask a question, an ignorant Canadian question for a second here? Why does New Jersey have so much of a mob component? Is it just a New York adjacent thing? Is this a geography thing? Is it as prominent as this show makes it sound? I genuinely don't know the answers to these questions.
I mean, the thing you got to think about is, A, New Jersey is an incredibly densely populated state. And so, at the earlier times, at the time of like Tony's father's heyday, like Newark was a big thriving city. Okay. Trenton was big, Jersey City. So there was these big urban areas in the same way that like Providence has a mob, Whitey Bulger was from Providence, right?
I believe so.
So, I think there's definitely like a legacy of that. I couldn't speak to whether the mob was quite as active in North Jersey by the time the show came on. But David Chase has told me and Matt stories over the years about like wise guys he knew and sort of events that he witnessed or heard about that got incorporated into the show.
Well, I mean, I would add to that. If you think about the geography of New Jersey, to Alan's point with Providence, the entire state borders the Atlantic Ocean. And if you think about what the mob tends to control or seize control, of course they're the disposing, but I'm not being glib. Yeah. I'm saying it's the opposite. It's the importing. How easily. It is controlling certain ports and the importing of whatever they need to import and controlling those unions. So obviously the gateway to New York as well, which, made a lot of sense. So I think that's why New Jersey has had this kind of storied history with the mob. That being said, there are mobs all over the country. And we've done so many movies. I mean, even the one we just did, In Too Deep, takes place in Cincinnati. Obviously it's not a mob, it's more of a gang, but mobs and gangs are the same thing, ultimately. So they're all over. But I do think that controlling what comes in and what comes out of the country, I think it's the same reason why, Miami has always been a hotbed for this kind of stuff. Getting stuff in and out.
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting because, very early on in the podcast, Kenny, we did analyze this, which was sort of the funny version of this, which came out a few months after this movie, after this show premieres.
Yes.
Despite the fact that people I think it's the other way around. It is interesting how this show drastically changed people's perspectives of the mob, I would say. It does feel like a bit of a, obviously there's something like 47 cast members of the of Goodfellas that that course around the Sopranos. So like it's not as though that's not a part of it, but it does feel very sort of, I mean, there's a quote here that that I found of from David Chase where he said, "I want to tell a story about this particular man. I want to tell the story about the reality of being a mobster or what I perceive to be the reality of life in organized crime. They aren't shooting each other every day. They sit around eating big ziti and betting and figure out who owes who money. Occasionally violence breaks out more often than it does in the banking world, perhaps." There is something very sort of real life about this show and about this series. Do you think that's one of the reasons, Alan, that the show hit in the way that it did?
I think it did. I mean, it's definitely, it's the first of like a lot of the shows that it inspired are sort of Trojan horses. I don't really think it's about the mob, or I really don't really think it's ultimately that interested in the mob. It uses it because it's colorful, because it heightens everything that's happening. And I know there's definitely a lot of fans who are entirely into the mob stuff and the whacking, but I think Chase's main interest is to talk about like what it's like to be a middle-aged person in America at this particular moment, the state of society, the state of the world, all of these things. And so it's grounded not just in the mob stuff, but just like, you know, Tony's having that big depressive episode late in season one and he can't get out of bed. And Carmela comes in and says, "I'm going to the Sports Authority to get sweat socks for AJ. Do you need anything?" Like it's, he lived in kind of this very recognizable, mundane world. And that made him, despite the fact that he's a murderous sociopath, people related to him. And because he was played by James Gandolfini, people liked him.
Well, it's Kenny, funny, I don't want to blow up your spot.
It's the funniest show ever made. But okay, go ahead.
But so you funny. Texted me the other day
so funny.
About how the show really speaks to you. You're a father. You obviously, you know, you have a wife, you have kids. And I think that perhaps this show, you know, a little triggering maybe, but also hit a vein.
It's not, I've seen the show in its entirety three times. This is, you know, I'm embarking now on a 4-3 watch with my son, who's 10, and who is
doing it at 10. That's a bold move, Kenny.
You know, Alan, he just ran, he ran Breaking Bad, and at this point, it's over. So I think
I would get the Felix Unger treatment if I like tried showing my kid those shows.
You know, the one thing, I mean, there's so many things I'll give my wife, but my wife was at HBO when the show was getting made, so she has a different kind of perspective on the stuff.
Yeah, sure.
But that being said, so. For the most part, I mean, every rewatch is different. You rewatch the first time in college, and it's just it's such a brilliant and exciting and vibrant show to begin with.
Yes.
And the last watch, you know, the one I watched right before we had kids, so 10 years ago, when my wife was on bed rest, we did a full rewatch, was, you know, a very different one. And the one now, the thing I get really in the pilot, because I watched 4 episodes this week. That's all we can get through. So the what I really get in the pilot, I wonder if you can relate to this, Alan, is the feeling that Tony has that every single person in his life is just constantly asking for things of him.
Yes.
Everywhere he turns, it's Tony, do this, Tony, do that, Tony, I need this, Tony, I need that. And that is the feeling that I have as a father of 4 and person with like a job and interests and parents. It's always, I need you here, I need you there, I need, and that was really the thing that I was like, oh man, maybe this is just about how difficult it is to be a modern parent.
Yeah, well, no, I think that's entirely right. And I think the parenting stuff was often the best things. There's the bit in, I think, early in season 2 where Meadow throws the party at Livia's house, and then Tony and Carmela have this conversation like, how are we going to punish her? And it's like, if we take away the car, then we have to drive her to places. And you know, if she realizes that, like, you know, we have no power, we're fucked. It's just, it's, there's so many bits like that. And I mean, I think that's one of the reasons Tony is drawn to Melfi, is she's the one person in his life who is not asking for anything from him and is in fact trying to help him. He's paying her for it, and he sort of can't like distinguish that from an actual relationship, and that causes problems later. But like, she's not trying to take anything out of him.
She's also the only person in his life that I feel like, anyway, he's close to being honest with. Like, obviously he's not fully honest with her. I guess what I mean is, it feels like she's the only person that makes him grapple with some of the real existential and mental things he's dealing with.
Well, when I did my rewatch a few years ago to write the Soprano Sessions book, what I was struck by is like, that's sort of my memory of it. But you watch the show, he really tells her very little. And a lot of it's not just about the mob stuff. It's also just about like how he's thinking. And you watch it and she like she will try walking him up to a breakthrough. And pretty much every time he either like takes the wrong lesson from it or he just willfully shuts down and, you know, just doesn't want to like grapple with the thing she's asking him to grapple with.
Sure.
So mostly what he gets out of the therapy is, you know, like Peter Bogdanovich says, he learns how to be a better gangster. But no, like he's really, I mean, he's full of shit with everybody, but in some ways he's most with her because she's the one he's trying to be honest with and he can't even bring himself to do it there.
Or he lashes out, uses the size, uses his you know, treats her the way he treats everybody else. I think that that's also, I mean, I love the show so deeply. And as I'm thinking more about it, you know, as I'm doing this rewatch now, why I love it so much. And it's because it, in so many, I mean, so many reasons, it has such incredible faith in the audience to understand what's happening two levels below. So there's so many shows that will have a, or show with therapy as a component that will have the therapist just spell out what's happening. Yeah. Right. Which Melfi does to some extent, but that's never actually what's happening. There's always another level below that. So you are these incredibly interesting and complex psychological and emotional ideas are introduced to the show, but that's not where the catharsis is found. There actually is never any catharsis in this show. But it's the way they use therapy is so unique.
Well, that was kind of what I was going to ask both of you guys in terms of what you think the show is saying about therapy and mental health. I mean, I think the show is, I'm not sure the show is really sure. Maybe I'm wrong, but what do you think, Alan?
I think the show is saying, and I've talked about this with David a lot over the years, it's not saying that change is impossible. It's saying, and I think this is a direct quote from David, it's very, very hard. And in life in general, like it's easy to be tempted. It's easy to sort of go back on things. And Tony is sort of both by nature and by nurture inclined to take shortcuts. Like he does kind of want to change, you know, he gets shot and he goes through his every day is a gift phase. And that lasts like an episode and a half. And then he just sort of gets bored with it or it's frustrating to him.
Winds up the worst he's ever was.
Yes, exactly. But like, I think he's making an effort. You see, Carmela is making an effort. There's when she goes to see the other therapist and he tells her, like, leave Tony, like, I won't take your blood money, get out. And she kind of half thinks about it and decides, I will have Tony make a donation to Columbia. And that's how I can assuage my guilt. You know, everyone throughout the run of the show is offered, or most people are offered, a chance to do something else with their lives on either a small or a large level. And nobody ever takes it, or they try and they give up quickly. And I think therapy is a part of that too. It's just, you know, because therapy is an attempt to sort of change the way you're thinking, the way you're feeling. And Tony tries and it never really takes.
And therapy is hard. Speaking from experience, you know, it's a lot of you get what you put into it. And I think that a lot of people expect it to be perhaps easier, that there's a pill or the whatever, like there's a magic bullet that can make it all kind of go away and I'll make it better. So I do appreciate that they don't make therapy easy in this show either. So I think that's interesting. I want to just take a quick second just to kind of talk about the TV landscape that The Sopranos entered in 1999 and obviously drastically altered for forever. I, Alan, you were on for the West Wing pilot. You and Emily St. James talked about the West Wing pilot. For quite some time, I would say for about 4 years, these two shows felt like the two bearing walls of television, right? Where you had the old guard, we'll call the old guard the West Wing in terms of just broadcast television, the best that it could offer at that time, let's just say for argument's sake, right? And then The Sopranos comes in and obviously just drastically changes the way television is made, the way television is distributed, all of it. And I've said this to you, Kenny, on many occasions, I'm curious as to sort of what that felt like at the moment, because it must have felt like an earthquake, or maybe not. I don't know.
I mean, it's kind of like, I keep using these rock analogies in part because like David loves rock music, but it must have been like you're somewhere in the middle of the 70s and there's all this dinosaur rock and prog rock and these sort of big unwieldy things. And then along come the Ramones, along come the Sex Pistols. And you're like, oh, wait a minute. Like, it can do that. It can make you feel like that. And obviously, The Sopranos is not stripped down. If anything, it's much more elaborate stylistically, thematically, and everything than what The West Wing was doing. But just in terms of like the attitude, the abrasiveness of it, the unwillingness to hold the audience's hand. I mean, it really is. The West Wing was the end of something, and The Sopranos was the beginning of something. The West Wing was sort of like everything that television drama had been building towards since the 1950s was, here is the show. It's very literary. It's very clever. It's very emotional. It's playing to a big tent in theory, you know, even though the politics were kind of left center. Sure. It's sort of trying to do all these things. It wants to tell you how to feel in every moment. And a few months earlier, here comes this show that not a lot of people watched in the first season. I think that's why everybody remembers Analyze This as coming first, because everybody caught up on Sopranos before season two started. But here comes this show that's like, it doesn't want to tell you what to think. It wants you to sort of figure out for yourself how you feel about things. Right. It's not going to explain everything. It's just going to sort of hurl you into the middle of it. It's going to have this main character who is not an anti-hero. He's just like a monster. And maybe it's going to sort of slow walk you into him being a monster, but it's never going to like hide from that. So it's doing all of these things. It's breaking all of these rules that we had been told our entire lives. Television is not allowed to do any of these things. Right. And it did all of them. And it eventually became a really, really big hit. And now obviously you look at television today, and it's not all The Sopranos, because obviously reality TV started around the same time. But like in terms of scripted TV, even comedy, I think is hugely influenced by The Sopranos in different ways.
I think, you know, I want to speak to the notion of the earthquake, because I think you're saying this, Alan. It was not an earthquake in any sense. This was a slow rumbling. This was a slow building storm, if I remember correctly, because so it airs in 99. I'm a senior in high school. Nobody is talking about it in my high school, right? This is not something that people were talking about. And on top, I mean, partially is because HBO had kind of done things that looked like this before. Mm-hmm. So it didn't seem like HBO was putting out appointment viewing, at least on the drama side. Mm-hmm. So that's part one. The other thing I would say about The Sopranos is it was the first real viral hit to me, right? Like it was the first thing that I remember people actually catching up on DVD. Yeah. Making a point of being like, all right, so this person says it's good. And this is before Netflix too. So people were buying the box sets and catching up on DVDs. I didn't watch a season of Sopranos live until season 4. Right. So I caught up in college with friends. Which is probably why I have this memory of Alan being, you know, the person who did it the whole time, because at that point I remember Simmons was linking to you and you kind of grew around that moment with that same thing. But it wasn't until season 4 when I felt like this has not only become appointment viewing, but the country as a whole is understanding Sunday night HBO is becoming appointment TV. Yep. It really wasn't getting that because also, you know, people wonder why The Wire didn't have any, you know, didn't like kind of rise in its wake. Well, there was no wake, you know?
Yep. And this is not anecdotal. You're talking about, Kenny, like the fourth season is the highest rated season of the show, which is funny because it's almost everybody's least favorite season of the show, including mine. But like that was around the point when the word of mouth had built and built and built. And people, like you say, had the ability to catch up on DVD and they started watching it live.
Yeah, I mean, I was, you know, as our listeners know, I was working in a video store at the time, and this was prime. Like, this is when 24, Alias, Sopranos, all those shows are fine. I mean, we couldn't keep them in the store. They were rented constantly. People
24
were constantly,
was another big one.
You know what I mean? These big, big catch-up shows. And it's interesting, Alan, you talk about how the fourth season, you know, 13, just shy of 14 million people watched the season premiere of the fourth season. You know, the first season finale had 5, right? So, like, you're seeing how, to your point, Kenny, it's this groundswell word of mouth thing that is kind of brewing. I guess when I said an earthquake, I mean, you're absolutely right, both of you, in the sense that it wasn't an earthquake. The question I meant ultimately is sort of creatively.
Yes.
As a writer, if I was a TV writer in 1999 and I watched an episode of The Sopranos, to your point, Alan, it would be, wait, we can do this now?
Well, and I'm not trying to push back, but you basically were a TV writer in 1999. And, you know, more or less, you were someone who's an aspiring TV writer. You're in college for it. You know, it still felt like Sopranos and, for my money, The Shield.
Yeah.
And The Wire.
Yeah.
Were not things that people were going to, you know, get on board with. That these were still little islands that had, you know, that were not archipelagos and were never going to be archipelagos. You know, they were just little things like The Prisoner, little things like, you know, these little weird one-offs throughout history that, you know, Twin Peaks that people were excited about, but nothing ever came of them.
But it should also be said too that, you know, speaking of the old guard, speaking of, not that the Emmys are a barometer of much of anything, but they are a barometer of something, I guess.
Yeah.
If you look at, you know, 99, top of 99, you've got The Practice that wins for 98. You've got The West Wing that wins for 4 years in a row until The Sopranos wins finally in season 5.
Yes.
That shows to some degree that the industry wasn't ready to let go either.
No, and even the media to a degree, like the first season reviews of Sopranos were pretty mixed. I'm remembering right, the Times was kind of dismissive of it. And then at some point they realized during the season, the editors realized, oh, this is becoming a thing. And they got a different writer to do a piece that basically like called it like, is this one of the great works of pop culture of the 20th century?
Yeah.
And that happened over the course of a season.
I don't want to call you out, Alan, but I'm going to do it very quickly.
Uh-oh.
Reminds me a little bit of what happened with Succession in season 1, too.
All right.
I was going to say that before I remember that.
Guys, I have a heart out. We got to talk Sopranos here. I got to get out of here.
No, I mean, I think there's, I do think, though, in terms of the Sopranos, don't you think a little bit of it was, I mean, the mobster thing too, right? I think people feeling like, have we seen this before?
Yes.
You know?
And the fact that there were all of those Analyze This trailers everywhere in the weeks leading and months leading up to the show premiering, you know, sort of, again, made people assume it was something else. And they put a joke in the season 2 premiere about that, where like Melfi is not seeing Tony anymore. And he tries a new therapist and the guy is very nervous. He's like, I've seen the movie Analyze This, and Tony, like Jim Gandolfini, is delivering like Analyze This. That's a comedy. That's, come on.
There's so many. I mean, one of the best aspects of the show is these guys have seen the movies and they love the movies. That's so funny to me. Like I've been watching with Rollins. He gets such a kick because we watched Godfather 2, obviously, because I'm a bad father. He gets such a kick out of him, out of all the Godfather lines. But
giving shit to Paramount for not having them on DVD is amazing, too. The Godfather movies is amazing.
So wait,
at that point, it hadn't been out on DVD. Anyway.
But here's the thing about mobster movies at the moment, too.
Yeah.
They were not cool. Like, the mob was not cool. And I think Sopranos is kind of keenly aware of it. These are the first mobsters I've ever seen who weren't cool. These are, you know, kind of old characters. Now, there's something else that did this, and we talked about it. The mob and Ghost Dog, the mobsters and Ghost Dog are so much like the mobsters in The Sopranos, but they're taking a little more seriously than Sopranos. But Ghost Dog and Sopranos are about the same exact thing. It's about how do you continue to be a mobster when being a mobster is so lame. Ultimately, it's not the same as it used to be. And then, you know, I think people have talked about this forever and ever. I'm sure you've talked about it a lot, Alan. The death of the mob as a analog for kind of the death of the American dream and kind of the death of a certain way of American life.
Yeah.
I think
came in at the end, the best is over. You know, he spells out the whole thesis of the show in that one line to Melfi.
Early on. And then to have 9/11 happen during the run of the show is so incredibly like powerful to me too. And Tony having to deal, you know, kind of grapple with these things in real time. He's so concerned with the mortality as is. He's so concerned about, you know, but also really concerned with, you know, being irrelevant. It's really, really powerful.
And then to have the finale titled Made in America also just feels like it's part of this sort of, I mean, the show, I mean, I would argue it might be one of the most American shows ever, like in terms of just a real, these characters just, they just feel very American to me. And I don't mean that in a judgmental or a derogatory sense.
Phil, you can go back where you came from with that comment.
You know what? I have a heart out too. Yeah. So
go watch that. Go back to Slings and Arrows. Come on.
I mean, listen, I again, the most American response to this question from both of you. But yeah, I just
get out of here.
I know, it's so great. I was watching episode 4 yesterday with my son, yeah. And they're sitting outside the pork shop, and just because the sound design of the show is brilliant, someone in the background just goes, because he was picked up on it, and he goes, "So I told them forget about it." Rollins goes, "Cheer him, say that." He said, "So I told them forget about it." It's so great.
I also think, just to piggyback on what something you were saying earlier, Alan, in terms of sort of the comparison between broadcast and what The Sopranos was doing,
yeah,
it was half the episodes as well, right? So from a production perspective, you're talking about these episodes. This was, I would argue, this was the first time that episodes felt special and filmic in a way, yeah, that obviously cable has ran with since then.
Yeah, and I mean, I think we've arguably taken it too far where we're now down to like 6 and 8 episode seasons, and like there's no time for anything to breathe.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I love about The Sopranos, and like people keep forgetting this because they have this like version of it in their heads that is not the actual show, is it's not super serialized. Most of it is just sort of like, here's a thing that happens in this episode. And yeah, like Richie Aprile is lingering in the background and causing problems, or Ralphie and Paulie are beefing. But for the most part, it's like a mob crisis of the week show. And every episode is sort of really handcrafted, and you get to like live and breathe with the characters and really get to know them, so that when you get to the end of seasons and big stuff starts going down and Tony grabs a pillow to smother his mom, like that matters in a way that it doesn't now. But yes, at the same time, 13 is not 22. And so it was much easier to do a bespoke version of the show than like, you know, David E. Kelly or Aaron Sorkin or Stephen Bochco could have done at the time.
Yeah, it's, I mean, I was reading all this stuff, you know, trying to do research for this, and just every part of this show was so thought through. Like David Chase, there was no, you know, people are glib about television, as we all know. They think it's made very easily. I don't think that they think about this sort of attention to detail. And this was one of the first shows where I mean, even the credit sequence, which is just, you know, David Chase in an interview talked about sort of the making of it. There were two quotes that I wanted to read from him that I think are really interesting. He said, "At one time, I wanted to use a different song every week for the titles to play over. And Carolyn Strauss from HBO said, that's not a good idea." And she's, I said, right, "Why is that? Smart. It seems like it's a really different, interesting way." And she said, "Because with a TV show title, you want it to be such that when people are in another room and they hear it, they go, oh, that show's on the air, and they come running." And he was like,
That was HBO's whole mantra with their throughout all their programming. I mean, if you think about it, Curb Your Enthusiasm, you can think of it immediately. Sex and City, you can think of it immediately. Even Entourage, you can think of it immediately. So yeah.
It's and Chase says about other songs he considered. He said, "Woke Up This Morning was the most interesting fit. There was Complicated Shadows, the Elvis Costello song. There was We Have All the Good Times, Where Have All the Good Times Gone by the Kinks. And there was You Better Run by the Rascals." I think I just can't even imagine anything. I mean, obviously the song is so iconic now, but just, I mean, It is truly one of those shows where you hear the first couple beats of the song and you're immediately transported into the world of the show. It's unbelievable.
And the thing is, I think the song's kind of crap. Like, I don't think it's a very good song.
It's not the best song.
But it's a very good opening title song.
Yeah.
I mean, look, fucking Where Everyone Knows Your Name isn't a great radio song, but, but you know, perfect for what it does. No, I think for me,
yeah,
you know, it has that same feeling as the, you know, when you're in the theater and a Star Wars, the opening fanfare hits and Star Wars comes on the screen. It's that same, like, I am transported back to 2004 summer of 2004, summer of 2005, whatever, sitting with my friends and so excited for the what the next hour is going to bring.
But I also, I want to just say one other quick thing about David Chase, because, I mean, we'll, obviously we'll talk about him more, but I do want to say that his desire to want to work in film is another thing that makes this show so great.
It's hilarious. David Chase hates television. Like, he made the greatest like television show of all time, or one of them, and he really just like wanted nothing to do with it. He didn't want HBO to pick up the show. He wanted to be able to like get independent financing to expand it to 2 hours and take it to Cannes. You know, it's like, even after he finished it, he's still like, I want to make movies. It's really, it's hilarious.
But, you know, I think the, to me, if you think about also where, to me at least, where HBO was in 1999, certainly not the destination it was now. The budgets were lower. The actors were smaller. I don't think people realize that James Gandolfini was not James Gandolfini. Right. I think people look at HBO, you know, leading women casting of the last 10, 12 years and think, oh, they've always got big stars like James Gandolfini. Not even kind of. Right. Not even kind of this.
They cast him off True Romance, if I'm not mistaken. It was one of the big roles that they cast him off.
He'd been in Crimson Tide, a couple Get Shorty.
Seventh, eighth, ninth down on the. I mean, he had just was done back, Get Shorty. It's a really good. It was a really good one because he was, you know, he was the seventh or eighth on the call sheet and getting his ass kicked by John Travolta in a parking lot.
Yeah, I mean, I remember I saw True Romance and the scene where like he's in Patricia Arquette's motel room. I just said, who the fuck is this guy? Like he had screen presence for days. But this was back in the day when HBO could do that, where they could build a show around two nobodies. In him and Edie Falco. And I mean,
Edie Falco's a real
Bracco,
nobody.
But yeah.
Yeah.
Because I was looking, because, you know, Lorraine Bracco obviously had the iconic role, right? So,
yeah.
She was probably kind of the biggest name at the time.
Yeah.
Edie Falco had done nothing. Like,
she'd been on Oz. That was it. Yeah.
Wasn't Lorraine offered Carmella and she chose Melfi or something to that
no
effect?
One of those myths that Chase kind of shot down is like, no, I've heard a million people say that. I don't know where it comes from. I never wanted her for that.
But what I was getting at with Gandolfini and with where HBO was at the time, these smaller budgets, and Phil, you remember, even when we were at ETA in 05, 06, HBO was the second choice, the third choice. You didn't really want to go there. You were getting paid less. You're working with, you know, with smaller budgets, et cetera, et cetera. This show and, a lot of the early HBO shows and a lot of the early FX shows, just are so inspiring in that when you have your chance to shoot your shot. So everything about like every decision they make and every casting choice they make, and they're so brilliant and bold and scary probably in the moment, but that's what made TV what it is today.
Kenny, not to interrupt, but the funny thing is when I did my book, The Revolution Was Televised, about a decade ago, I interviewed everyone involved in Sopranos. And I interviewed Chris Albrecht, who is an unfortunate human being, but like was there at the time at the founding of this. And like he was very open about the fact that with Oz, especially, but even with Sopranos, a lot of the decisions were made basically because like TV was not original content was not a priority at HBO at the larger company. And so it's like, well, let's try something. I don't know. Like, what if we only did 13 episodes? What if we just let him cast this nobody who had a good audition? It was sort of, and even David Chase, like a lot of the times, a lot of the things that seem kind of brilliant about the show, he's like, I don't know. I don't remember really thinking too deeply about it. We just sort of did it.
But even, you know, I was like, even the buttons on the scenes, buttons on the scenes are the kind of things you would never do, but they're so funny. But
even
they're
the
just
endings of episodes sometimes aren't. I mean, like, this was a show that I vividly remember watching back in the day, and when the final credit would come up, right, like black screen, whatever, and it'd be like, really? Like, you have to, sometimes you really did have to grapple with what was the show saying by ending where it ended. And I don't think I, as a viewer up until that point, had ever really had that before.
You did.
You know what I mean?
No, like, yes. you just didn't.
It's just it's now it's common, and I really can't stress enough how crazy that was as a viewer at the time, because it challenged you as a viewer, and TV was never a challenging medium before that.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/spoken today.
This is a paid advertisement from BetterHelp. As a podcast listener, you've heard from us before. Today, let's hear from our members about what online therapy has done for them.
I would recommend my therapist 1,000 times over. She has truly changed my life.
The day after my first session, my friends and family said I sounded like myself again for the first time in weeks.
You deserve to invest in your well-being. Visit BetterHelp.com to see what it can do for you. That's better, H-E-L-P.com.
It just wasn't.
No, it really wasn't. You, like, the audience was, we were told, they had a long day. They want to sit down. They want to relax. They don't want to have to think. Yep. Thinking is bad. Yeah. You've got to tell them everything they're supposed to understand here. Yeah. And David Chase is like, no, like, you know, I loved like the French New Wave films. I love Blow Up. I loved seeing, yeah, you know, yeah, Planet of the Apes and sort of arguing about what the Statue of Liberty meant, all these kinds of things. It's, yeah, like that was his main bag. You know, Twin Peaks is like his favorite TV show.
Yeah. I mean, it's, I feel like, just because it sort of makes sense to talk about it very briefly here, but like the series finale of this show, as over talked about as it is still so groundbreaking and breathtaking because it gives zero fucks about its audience.
Yep.
And I think that's, I mean, I know that Kenny and I, and obviously you do too, Alan, think it's brilliant, but I mean, think about that for a second. I mean, it's so crazy to think about. I mean, you were at UTA at the time, right, Kenny, when the finale aired, or were you not?
So 06? Summer 06?
07.
07.
Summer 07, I was already at Entourage.
Okay, because I remember the day after it premieres, David Chase was represented at UTA. I was working at UTA at the time. He was represented by Peter Benedict. He walks into the bowl and immediately says, I don't know what it means. Like, literally to everybody. Like, spent the entire day on the phone with people calling him saying, can you please explain to me what the end meant? I think that's fucking amazing.
Oh, my God. But here's the thing. Here's the thing.
Yes.
On the one hand, it gives zero fucks.
Yes.
On the other hand, as just like a piece of filmmaking, it's goddamn brilliant.
Yes,
like, it's well crafted. And that to me is kind of the Sopranos in a nutshell. Like, it's, yeah, it's television made by a guy who hates television, but it's really like great episodic television too.
Right.
Like, it's just all about the creative was really, really masterful.
I love that. I love the finale more than anything. I hate Pat finales. They bore the shit out of me, but that's not even the point. That was people. Look, I understand why people expected something different from the show. I understand why viewers of television who were never confronted with this type of show and this type of ending were upset. I don't understand why, you know, anybody would watch like White Lotus right now and be concerned about who's dying. I don't intellectually understand why at this point in our development as human beings, why people would care about that stuff. Like it's some kind of fucking mystery box. But no, I think the ending is perfect. I think any debate around it is incredibly stupid. I can't think of a bigger waste of time. I feel like it's okay to say I think I know the answer to what happened.
Sure.
It cut to black and that's the end of the show.
Yeah.
So there is no fucking answer. There is no answer.
I also just want to say too, I don't know about you guys, but when I watched it for the first time, the fucking tension of Meadow trying to parallel park. And it's funny, but it is, I couldn't take it. It was unbelievable.
The whole scene understands the assignment. It wants you to sort of be jumping out of your skin at every moment. Even though if you rewatch it carefully, Tony is not paranoid. Tony's having a fine old time at the diner. He looks at the door just because it's something you would do if you were at a diner and your booth was like facing the door. But it's not like he's paranoid. He's thinking anyone who comes in could kill me. He's having a great time. We are not. We're going crazy.
Yeah, it's incredible. And I mean, the show does it many, many times over through the run of episodes. I do think, though, and I don't know if you have insight into this, Alan, is there a reason why David Chase only directed the pilot and the finale?
Basically, he was too busy. He wanted to do it more. Like he always wanted to direct. You know, it was sort of a huge disappointment to him that he couldn't direct the Sopranos movie a few years ago due to some family stuff. Right. But no, he wanted to do it. It's just, you know, the way he show ran was so all consuming that he did not have the time.
That's interesting. Okay, that's fair. Yeah. It did make me think about your podcast, Alan, of first and last episodes that you do, which is great, and everybody should listen to it. Too long didn't watch. My apologies. This would be an interesting one to do. Would you ever do it?
I mean, when we've gone out to like the celebrity guests, no one has picked it. Like we give them a list of potential shows, and I guess in most cases they've seen it. It's part of the problem.
Right.
But yeah, this would be a fascinating one because, like, obviously, like, a lot of the conflicts are different. A number of, like, the mobsters that we care about are gone. And the finale picks up with Tony sort of at the tail end of this war with New York. And so maybe that's difficult to follow. But at the same time, like, it's a family problem. The bulk of the final episode is, what are we going to do with AJ? It's
right.
What direction is our idiot son going to take and how can we help him? So he doesn't wind up like becoming a helicopter pilot for Donald Trump or whatever stupid idea he has. That's among the different potential occupations he lists over the course of the episode.
I love AJ so much. AJ is one of my favorite characters on the show.
Is he?
He is. I mean, he has one of my favorite moments.
He has the moment that I think is Robert Eiler's, you know, I could have been a contender, which is when he goes to stab Junior and he can't do it. And then he's in the parking lot with Tony and he can't even throw up. He just drives.
Yeah.
I mean, I say that AJ is one of my favorite characters because he's so inept and there's something so, I don't know, emblematic to some degree. I do. I mean, obviously it's an enormous cast of characters.
You ever see Multiplicity?
Sure.
Alan, you've seen Multiplicity?
A million years ago. Yes.
Great flick.
Sure.
So Michael Keaton, you know, he clones himself twice and then the clones decide to clone himself and that fourth clone comes out really wonky.
Yeah.
So I think I look at it like Tony is a clone of Johnny Boy and he's not exactly Johnny Boy and he's a product of his environment. But AJ is a clone of Tony and he's just a disaster. Right? AJ can't even function. That's his whole thing. Like AJ is so his genes, his nature and his nurture are so unbelievably fucked up that he can't even begin to function in society. And I love that about him. Yeah. And I think that's incredible. It's really bold writing. I'd be really upset if I was David Chase's child. But I love that idea
of making AJ not want to be his dad or incapable of being his dad like that, you know what I mean? The easy choice would have been just to make, you know, Tony Jr.
Of course.
Like, it's just so great that he's.
Of course.
Not.
Yeah. And then you see a little bit of it with like Jackie Jr. You know, you get that little thing, which is pretty powerful. I love that run. Yeah. But it's a crazy move to make AJ like the worst version of Fredo.
He really is. I have to ask a question, Alan, and it's kind of an impossible one, but I'm sure you've been asked it before, so maybe you have an answer. Do you have some favorite episodes? Do you have episodes that jump out at you?
Yeah, absolutely. White Caps, which is when Carmela kicks him out of the house. Like, just the acting duet between Jim and Edie is fantastic.
Incredible.
Long-Term Parking, the last Adrian episode, obviously incredible, tragic. College, I mean, you're sort of sounding like a basic, you know, when you pick college, but like that's the show when the Sopranos becomes the Sopranos. Oh God. I mean, there's a lot.
So college is the one when he kills the guy, correct?
He kills Febby on the college tour with Meadow. And it was this big deal because he hadn't seen Tony kill somebody before, but television show main characters were not supposed to murder people. Or if they did, the people they were murdering were absolute monsters, like, you know, Magnum PI guns down like this KGB torturer guy. And that's okay, but this was not that.
Well, so the show in its first season, it wins writing for College, right? College is the episode that it wins, and Edie wins. Is that correct?
Jim definitely didn't win the first year. I think you may be right about Edie.
Yes, yeah, Edie wins. Yeah. It's nominated for everything else you can imagine. But those are the two things it wins in season one, which I do think is interesting. Listen, College is a great episode, to get me wrong, but to not give it to the pilot's kind of incredible to me, because the pilot's amazing.
Yeah, I get it. Although it does feel like a lot of the time Emmy voters kind of default to the pilot in this sort of thing. So I like the fact that
I'm
this case,
I'm a big fan of not giving
College.
It to the pilot.
Totally get that.
The pilot's almost never the best episode. I think the pilot's great.
Sure.
And I think it does some things like, look, I think his relationship with his mother is as revolutionary as killing Febby. I think that antagonistic relationship with the main character's mother, where they truly deeply hate each other, I've never seen anything like it. I don't think I've ever seen anything like it since.
They hate each other.
That's really the crux of the first season and change of the show.
Alan, is it true that that's emblematic of David Chase's relationship with his mother? It seems that people have expounded.
I mean, it was inspired by it, you know, and he said that, like, maybe over the course of the show, he obviously, like, exaggerated things. And I don't think, like, Mrs. Ditch's RA actually at any point attempted to have her son whacked in the same way that Livia did. But definitely, like, I mean, the gem of the show, the germ of the idea, was him always telling his friends stories about his mom, until one day, like, I think his wife Denise says, David, you should just write a show about her. And originally it was going to be like, you know, the main character was a screenwriter, and Chase realized nobody's going to want to watch that. But if he's a wise guy, that's a show.
Yeah, I couldn't conceive of someone coming up with that having not lived it, if you know what I mean.
No, 100%.
You know?
I'm just looking at the episodes that won for writing, just for what it's worth over the years, which I do think is kind of interesting. In season three, it's Employee of the Month, Green and Brown.
Oh, that's a good one. That's the one where where Melfi gets raped and they that's really.
Yeah, although, geez, we're talking episodes and I didn't even name Pine Barrens. Okay, that's right. That's a fail by me. Okay,
well, keep it going. Again, you know, an incredible season three has some incredible. I mean, this show has incredible episodes across the board, but Employee of the Month is one that I've always has just really stayed with me for obvious reasons. A very harrowing episode, but I think what has always stayed with me is that she refuses to tell Tony. Like, she refuses to use him as revenge.
But that's a really fascinating case of, again, as much as the show wanted to challenge the audience was not ready to be challenged. Because I remember throughout that year, every single week, people were like, when is she going to tell him about the rapist? When is she going to tell him about the rapist? Maybe that's going to happen in the finale. Like, people keep assuming that's what it's going to be, as opposed to looking at the way the episode ends. She says no, cut to credit.
Yeah.
That is the end of that story. It's, I mean, I think there's one other time where, like, I think she sort of thinks about him, but that's it. It never, like, she is never going to tell Tony Soprano this thing about herself.
Yeah. It's, I mean, that's what makes it so powerful. I don't want to see some fucking, like,
well, it's not a matter of
the guy, and
it's not a matter of if you want to see it or not. He does things the whole series that you don't want to see.
Yeah, it's like the really, next episode is the stripper gets beaten to death in the Bing parking lot. Right. I did not want to see that.
Yeah, it's more of a matter of, it would have destroyed Melfi's ability to have those scenes with Tony and continue doing what she was doing. But what is interesting, kind of in concept, is that we know as an audience by this point in the show that Tony cares enough about her that he would have done it for her.
Yes,
for nothing.
Of course.
He considers her family at that point, even if he wouldn't say that. And that to me is, like, really interesting at that point. So I love that, you know, because in the third episode, for instance, which I just saw and I think is brilliant.
Is that No.
The third episode is one of
the motels.
Yes, denial, with the motel,
yeah.
The motel on the Haas seeds, where, you know, Tony essentially is doing a job for a friend and is getting something back in return. And he's willing, you know, he is in some circumstances a gun for hire, just like all these guys are gun for hire. They contract out jobs to other mobs all the time throughout the show. But Tony only would go after someone on a personal level if it was somebody he cares about. So I think that's really cool.
I think it's the way he asks her at the end, like essentially like, can I help? Are you okay? Like, I don't know what the actual dialogue is, but it is quite, to your point, Kenny, caring. Like, he cares about her. It's yeah. I mean, Melfi and his relationship goes through some weird ups and downs over the course of the series, obviously, but but it is fascinating. Just to round off this thing, season 4, Whitecaps wins. Also, yep. Burgess and Green. Season 5, as you can imagine, Long Term Parking. Terry Winter wins. And then season 6 is obviously Made in America. But yep. Yeah, it is interesting. I don't know. With shows like this, this sort of perennial show that goes on and on and on and is at the sort of the top of the food chain, what the Emmy voters decide to kind of latch on to tend to be pretty seismic episodes or talked about episodes.
Yes.
But also I think we can talk about Adriana real fast because love Adriana, and I always was kind of taken with the fact that she has one line in the pilot, and I don't think she's ever really intended Dredd Allen to be
hostess, no it was just
was the name of,
she's the hostess. I think that at some point they realized after they made the pilot, Christopher needs a girlfriend. She should sort of like, he should be dating up more or less. So she's got to have some level of glamour. And he remembered liking her line reading, Dre's line reading in the pilot, and said, well, what if it's her? And then they throw in a line in like the next episode or two where she just mentions in passing, like, thank Tony for getting me that hostess job.
Mm-hmm.
Even though she looks completely different.
And by the third or fourth episode, she's, you know, a very important part of the show. I mean, when Chrissy thinks he's going to get whacked, she's like ready to move to Florida with him. Yep. So it's really her arc throughout the 5 seasons she was on the show is incredible. And you kind of see it over and over again with the show. You certainly see a lot of villains like Ralphie getting whacked.
Yeah.
But you see a lot of people who are like veering towards the light and they get whacked. And that's very depressing, too. You know,
she's not a show with a lot of hope.
No, I mean, she's, you know, when is she first approached by the FBI? Alan?
They set up the idea at the end of season 3 with Fairuza Balk, who was then fired and recast, and they reshot like her one scene for some reason. But season 4 is when Lola Glaudini is the new actress, is approaching her and brings her in, and she throws up in like the FBI conference room and all of that. And they put her in this impossible position because she's basically too naive to realize what she's supposed to do here.
It is when that shoe drops and when the FBI comes into her life, it's a foregone conclusion, right? Like, on some level, you've got to say to yourself, like, it's a 50-50 shot here. She either somehow is able to navigate this minefield and survive or die, and you know in your mind the more likely scenario is she's going to get whacked. And
so much of this show to me is hoping and praying that Chris sees the light. Like, that's like that is to me, that is the fundamental wish you want throughout the show. And hopefully this thing at this moment is going to be the thing where he's like, fine, bridge too far.
All right. But I want to interrogate that for a sec, Kenny, because this is interesting. You're hoping for this, and I'm not saying you're wrong to hope for this, but like, over the first few seasons, you see Chris murder people. You see Chris like beat up people. Chris is awful. And yet like there's this hope for him. And it reminds me that I was at the season, whatever the season is, where one of the subplots in the premiere is that Paulie keeps sticking Christopher with the check at dinner, and Christopher gets madder and madder about it. Then finally they're at some dinner and they like wind up stiffing the waiter for a tip.
Is that
on
$1,000 shit out of the guy?
They murder him
in the parking lot. They murder him. Yeah. Okay.
The waiter comes out to like basically demand a tip. Paulie throws a rock at him. The guy starts having a seizure, and so they kill him. And I was at like, and I went to the premiere party, and afterwards I'm like waiting in line at a bar, and some woman says, well, what did you think of the premiere? And I asked her what she thought. She said, well, I don't know. I don't like that Christopher's still shooting heroin. He's such a nice boy. I'm like, nice boy. He and Paulie just murdered that waiter. And she says, yeah, but the waiter asked for it. He was talking back. Like, there's sort of this way, like, you sort of, you get really Stockholm syndrome-y with these characters. Everybody.
Without question. People get, people got very deep into their, you know, fucked up psyches in a weird way. But
Spider has anything to do with it?
I think that's how he got the role. But
No.
You mean in terms of why we love him?
I'm just speculating.
I don't think. Spider. I don't think Spider has to do. I think Imperioli's, no. You know, a uniquely brilliant actor, in this particular role. I think the fact that he is, I think everything they do. You know, he's the only mobster you really get to know from the beginning who's not made. And I think I think that's a big part of it, which is he's on the outside looking in. He's the little brother who has dreams of running with the Sopranos crew. He's willing to do everything he can to get their, to get their attention. You've seen like what essentially is within the context of the show, a functioning relationship with Ariana and with Adriana. And you hope that I remember very clearly because they lead you down an alley in Long-Term Parking. You really don't know. I mean, I know everybody in retrospect is like, of course she was going to. I didn't know until she was in the car with Silvio that's what was going to happen. So at least I was praying.
I mean, if I'm being honest,
Silvio doesn't kill a lot of people. So that was a surprise too. Yeah.
And also they kind of do the obviously the psych out of thinking that she got away. And I genuinely thought she got away. So that was
once you cut from her alone in the car to her with Silvio,
yes.
Obviously, even if he doesn't kill her, he's bringing her to someone who's gonna kill her.
Yeah, it's I on the Christopher thing, I also just want to unpack that a little bit too, Kenny, in terms of how he dies, you know, which is obviously it's awful, but at the same time, I mean, Tony looking at the car seat, it's just sort of like, yeah, this guy fucking sucks. He's not a good kid. Like, he's never going to be a good person. I don't know. Like,
he's never going to be a good mobster. That's why he killed Tony. He wasn't condemning him to hell because he was like, this guy was never going to be the guy. He's never again going to be the guy who I need in my life.
But also, he's a threat to me because he's unreliable, because he's a junkie. He cannot kick the heroin. And sooner or later, he's going to get picked up and he's going to talk and it's going to be a headache for me. So he's got to die.
Was that Kennedy and Heidi?
Kennedy and Heidi, yes. And Matt likes to say that the scene right after the accident is kind of the Rosetta Stone for the show, where you see these two girls and one of them is like, you know, Heidi, we got to go back. I can't, Kennedy. I'm on my learner's permit after dark. And again, it's classic Sopranos of you have people who have the opportunity to do the right thing and they do not, out of self-interest and out of choosing what is easier for them, again and again and again and again.
It is one of those shows where, like, I mean, obviously we could talk about this for hours because there's just so much there. It's so rich. I mean, I genuinely find myself, I rewatched a bunch of it during the pandemic. And I texted you during that, Kenny, because I was just like, you hit play on this thing and you're just like, it's a miracle. It's a miracle. It's this perfect, wonderful thing that, I mean, truly, think about how many shows exist because it exists. I mean, we're so lucky that it happened. And yet at the same time, David Chase kind of would have been fine with adding 45 minutes to it, having it at Cannes and, I don't know, getting an overall somewhere else. Just, it's kind of amazing.
Yeah, no, he's so dismissive. I remember like one time I was talking to him about the fact that like the show changed, A, how he thought about television, but just like the notion of like TV as art.
Yeah.
And he basically said, like, yeah, but I don't really know what's like better about this than a movie version. I guess you get to spend more time with the characters.
Incredible.
Like, even he refuses to see what he's
called. This whole generation mm-hmm. of people who fell into TV because they felt like they couldn't either wait out the movie system or hack into the movie system and made the best TV ever made. and all hate it. It's like, I mean, even, you know, look, I'm obviously, massive disclaimer, I am not comparing Entourage to Sopranos. Yes, sure,
sure. But I would hang up the Zoom call if you did.
But every, but there was a refrain in the writer's room, which was, we're making half-hour movies. We're making half-hour movies. And
that's
everybody's
like worst nightmare.
Well, now I mean, hanging up the Zoom call.
No, but I understand why, of course, why you feel that way and why we all feel that way. And I also kind of understand why they would say it. And I think this ended right around when we moved out, Phil.
Yep.
Right around when we started our career. I remember, you know, it's 2004, 2005. I came out planning, hoping to be a screenwriter because I'm a movie boy. And very early on, an agent friend of mine, or a friend who would soon be an agent, said, you should not be a screenwriter. Because being a screenwriter is really hard. There's so few of you. It takes years and years and years to make movies. You should be a TV writer because, you know, things are getting made and TV is getting better and this and that and the other thing. And even as like a 21, 22 year old, I'm like, ugh, TV. Like, I'm going to go write TV. Of course, you know, now you have a whole generation of people who grew up with quality TV and that's what they want to do. But the people about 10 years older than us, particularly drama writers, are almost all failed screenwriters. So I think that, you know, failed screenwriters who were a little embarrassed to even be there and told themselves it's okay by saying, I'm making half hour or hour movies.
And then we have the inverse of it, which is feature writers consciously working in quote unquote television in the sense of like, you know,
well, that's just,
you know what I mean? This is a whole other thing.
Bad thing.
But it is true what you're saying, Kenny. I moved out here. When I moved out here in 2005, I got a job at UTA. Specifically, I wanted to work in the MP Lit, Motion Picture Literature Department. I wanted to work in the feature department. 3 months of working at UTA, I was like, there's no career path. There's no trajectory. It's like, it's
certainly not a sane one.
Certainly not a sane one. So yeah. I was like, maybe television is the way to go. And you know, obviously, I do feel incredibly lucky that I get to do it. But it should be said too, Kenny, looking at like the development of this pilot, for instance, is such an anomaly. You've got, he basically, from Lloyd Braun was David Chase's manager at the time. He signs a development deal with Brillstein Gray in 95 to write this pilot, which in and of itself is sort of, I mean, not really a pathway in the same way that obviously we see today. It was just sort of this, it feels a little bit like a random pilot he wrote and was just like, I guess I'll do this.
He took it around town. He took it to CBS. CBS like didn't want Tony to be in therapy. He took it to Fox. They're like, well, we've got to deal with Anthony LaPaglia. Could he be Tony? You know, he sort of, he took it around town and
that was
finally
a famous thing. It was on with LaPaglia. Yeah.
Yeah, and finally it wound up at HBO, you know, basically because HBO, as I said, like didn't really know what they were doing and said, all right, let's try this.
Say one other thing about David Chase that, like, God love him, was 54 when this got made.
Yep.
Do you know how fucking old that was in 99 for a TV writer? Yeah. That was 1,000. Thousand.
Yeah.
Like, that's truly crazy to me.
He had to be thinking. I mean, listen, obviously, you know, for people that David Chase worked in television for many years.
It was a Rockford Files.
Night Stalker, Rockford Files, Northern Exposure. I mean, the guy was a journeyman in terms of working on a bunch of different. He was a showrunner on Northern Exposure. He created a show called I'll Fly Away, which I've never seen. And
He did not create it. He showran it for a while.
Showran it.
The show he created was Almost Grown with Tim Daly.
Okay.
I'll Fly Away is the least like The Sopranos of any show ever made.
It's very inspiring about the civil rights era South. Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, it's just he did win 2 Emmys previous to The Sopranos, one for the Rockford Files and then one for a television film off the Minnesota Strip, which I don't know, but I guess he won an Emmy for it. You know, I just think it's fascinating to your point, Kenny, 54 years old, you know, what I would assume the industry thought was a guy who was over the hill, like this was never going to happen.
Without question.
Right. And then he just changes the entire fucking game.
I mean, now, for real, like now writers. I mean, now writers right into their 50s, 60s have, you know, a lot of these people who were coming up then coming up in the late 90s, early 2000s. Like that's that's certainly expanded. But, you know, Phil, because we were at UTA. If you weren't David Chase, if you weren't, you know, who are the other big ones we had? If you weren't, you know,
Alan Ball. I mean,
Alan Ball. Alan Ball was even young. I mean, there were like a few, like there were a few Lions who stuck around. But for the most part, if you were over 50, if you were over 50, you were done.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it was, I don't know. It just feels like
Tom Fontana was who I was thinking of.
Yes. But exactly, yes. Exactly.
Yeah. Like a Tom Fontana kept making shows. Stephen Bochco kept making shows. But you're talking about, you know, the fucking biggest to best writers of all time.
Yeah. It's crazy to think how much of sort of the tip of the spear this show was, not just creatively, but also just in terms of changing the game, to your point, Kenny, as to when you can make a show, you know, when you can get out there and still do something like this. I do have a one last question for you, Alan, as we wrap this up, because I'm curious as to whether or not you have thoughts on this and whether or not you've gleaned this from David Chase in your many interviews with him. What do you ultimately think he was trying to say with the series? Like, do you think he had a thesis statement?
I mean, I think that it's like resignation. It was sort of looking at the state of his life, the state of life in America, the state of life in the world, and saying, like, what are we doing here? Like, why are we doing this to ourselves, to each other, to the planet? You know, I mean, there's a lot of environmentalism stuff in there, too, in terms of the waste management and the asbestos and everything else. And I mean, the unfortunate thing about both the great and unfortunate thing about the show is that basically everything he was saying turned out not to be cynical, but turned out to be accurate.
Yeah.
And you only have to look at like the last 6-7 years of American life to know that.
No, absolutely. I mean, the show was incredibly prescient and really did understand sort of the plights or the plight of this country, this planet, and of being a person like Tony, you know what I mean? Of being someone who
we didn't talk about Meadow either, but that it's one of the best portrayals and one of the best depictions of a teenage girl you'll ever see.
Absolutely.
A teenage girl who can't wait to go to Berkeley and get away from her family.
And then she goes to Columbia instead because the show needed her.
Well, also because I mean true, but also because those people do generally stay home.
Yes.
You know, like it is, I think it does thematically fit with the, you know, take with the whole show. To me, the whole show is these people always take the deal. The deal being the devil's bargain. They always take the deal. I have a question for you, Alan.
Yes.
If I had a Sight and Sound list and I put Sopranos on it, would that be an acceptable choice artistically? And would I get lambasted on Twitter? Because there is some motherfucker
who keeps putting David Lynch's
who put Twin Peaks The Return on it. So if I
fuck that guy.
you're saying hard no.
Yeah. Again, I just talked about medium? This. Like this is an episodic television show. It's not a goddamn movie. What are you doing to me here?
It is amazing.
Who's the guy who puts Twin Peaks The Return?
I don't know.
I don't. It always drove me nuts too that there's one television show in the history of the medium that everyone decided is actually a movie.
It's crazy. It is crazy because like
they're all TV shows except this one is actually a movie. Is it?
Well, the funny thing about about Twin Peaks The Return is it is episodic. Like it's so clearly episodic. And yes. I don't even mean just in the way that it was distilled in terms of the way that we watched it. I just mean in the terms that, like, this was not a 12-hour script that was chopped into pieces.
This is the episode where Dougie Jones does this.
Right.
This is the black and white episode with, like, the woodsman, you know?
It's so clear to me that this was delineated that way. It's crazy.
Childish. It's so childish. It's the equivalent of the people who are like, I don't watch TV, but I watch The Simpsons. I mean, go fuck yourself.
Okay, cool.
You know,
right? Yeah, although Simpsons was and can be great from time to time, but I
Great. That's not my point. Yeah. My point's the exact opposite. Is that there's this one thing that rises to my level of sophistication.
Yes,
you know, there's this only
I watch Masterpiece Theater, but that's not television.
My level of sophistication.
Right. Right. No, 100%. I mean, listen, this was obviously, Alan, a blast to have you on, to have you talk about this. You were, you know, there was no question that you needed to be the guy to come on and talk about this with us. We're so grateful to have you unpack the show for the millionth time with somebody.
Well, look, I'm sure I just like that people doing a podcast about pop culture in the year 1999 remembered to do an episode about The Sopranos, because I was worried it was going to end without it.
Oh, there was no question we were going to do it.
We wanted to do the whole season, but
we did. That it was just
life got in the way.
Yeah.
Alan, I think I've told you before, you're one of my true heroes, and you've made my life better in ways you'll never understand. I mean, truly, so many of us, people who love television, have you to thank, but I'm aware of it. So thank you.
Kenny, you are very, very welcome, and you can pay me back by telling all of your listeners to purchase The Soprano Sessions by Alan Sepinwall and Matt Zoller Seitz, still available wherever fine books are sold.
Alan's
previous books too. He's never written anything bad.
He's never written anything bad.
You know that really, you know what I really do love is you. Mm. I mean, because I love The Revolution was televised, and the fact that you started with Oz made me go back and watch all of Oz, and that was a rewatch I don't think I ever would have done. So, and I would say I'd never watched that in its entirety, beginning to end. I watched episodes here and there. So that was really very helpful, because it's obvious. I agree with you. That's where it started.
Yeah. Well, and I would strongly advise any of our listeners who love television, want to work in television, read that The Revolution was televised. It is, I mean, it's unbelievable what you were able to sort of do in terms of seeing the whole arc of so many brilliant television shows. It also makes me sort of wistful for that time in television, because I feel like right now we're in some sort of, I don't know what. There's a lot of great TV out there.
Are you going to write two? Are you going to write up? Are you going to
write another one?
We've talked about it, like maybe doing like basically the streaming era.
The Revolution was streamed.
Yeah.
But part of that would be frustrating, because I feel like one of the great things about doing that book was most of like the important shows and the big shows were the same shows. Right. Whereas I think in a lot of the streaming era, it's kind of going the other way. So like you can have something like Game of Thrones, which is both mostly great and very important. And you can have something like Walking Dead or Ozark or whatever that are big, but I think mostly not that great. So,
well, and I also feel like, I mean, there is so much content now, Alan.
Yeah.
You'll go fucking crazy trying to cover it all.
And also, unfortunately, there would have to be an entire chapter about Louis, and I do not really want to write about Louis or Louis C.K. Yeah,
that's fair.
So, that in and of itself may keep me from doing it.
That's fair. But you've written amazing books. Your podcast is great. Everyone needs to follow you on. You have a new. Do you have a Substack, or you have something?
Yes,
like that?
My Substack is alanseppinwall.substack.com. Just Google my name. I'm the only person with that name in the world. There's only 12 people with the last name, thanks to a Canadian immigration official with a weird sense of humor. So yes,
I'll tell you the story another time, Phil. I too am I think Phil probably also. We are unique name people. So
we are unique.
I like that. Everyone with my name is related to me.
But Alan, honestly, you're a very busy guy covering all the television in the world. So we appreciate you taking the time to come on.
I was
here.
Not going to allow you to have Emily or some other such person to talk about The Sopranos.
It would have been Emily. It would have been Emily. So
Emily can go to hell. You know,
it was you or Robert Eiler. So that was it.
Thank you so much, Alan. We so all appreciate it.
My pleasure, guys. You take care. Well, congratulations on everything you've done with the show.
Oh, thank you.
We appreciate it. Podcast like it. Just podcast like it. Podcast like it's 1999. Podcast like it. You want a podcast like it? 1999.
Your personal info, like addresses, phone numbers, and more, are collected and sold by data brokers. But Aura steps in, scanning the web, sending you alerts, and requesting your info be removed. Get Aura's full toolkit, including credit and transaction monitoring, a password manager, VPN, and more. Get a 14-day free trial at aura.com/safety. That's aura.com/safety.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
The Real Housewives is a guilty pleasure for most. But if you're looking to not feel guilty about that pleasure, tune in to Everything Iconic with me, Danny Pellegrino, where I break down all the messy moments and behind-the-scenes antics of Bravo's popular franchise. And on Everything Iconic, I also interview celebrity guests like Kelly Ripa, Keke Palmer, Drew Barrymore, Cameron Diaz, and more about their guilty pleasures, their past work, and so much more. So if you're pop culture obsessed and find yourself watching way too much reality TV like me, tune in to Everything Iconic with Danny Pellegrino, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.